I remember a time of chaos, ruined dreams, this wasted land. But most of all, I remember the road warrior, the man we called Max. To understand who he was, you have to go back to another time.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Mad Max Retrospective Series.
Not this again! I've been assigned!
Join Garrett.
Perfect in every way.
Matt.
You. It's your lucky day.
And the returning Mick Duffy.
Remember me.
As they review the franchise that revolutionized low-budget filmmaking.
Hey, listen, man, will you listen to me?
From the gritty 1979 Mel Gibson starring original.
I've seen the style before, Terminal Psychotic.
To the 2015 mega hit, Mad Max Fury Road.
Max. My name is Max.
All the way to George Miller's prequel, Furiosa.
This one has all her teeth.
The boys will review each film in the series, one car chase at a time, to see why and how this franchise just keeps on going.
Together they can be very powerful.
So strap yourself in, percolated media listeners.
What are you doing? Praying? To who? Anyone that's listening.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Mad Max series begins now.
Now we bring home the booty!
All the children say, we don't need another hero. We don't need to run away home. All we want is what we are.
Mad Max Fury Road. Released May 15th, 2015. Budget on this was $185 million. Box office, $380.4 million. And this is directed by George Miller. Wow. 30 years later, we get the fourth Mad Max film. 30 years. Mick, you see Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Did you think we would ever see another sequel to that film?
Not for the longest time, no. Because I don't even remember, but during the sort of certainly the late 80s through to the early 90s, Mel Gibson didn't seem to like being referred to, you know, as the star of Mad Max. I remember quite a few interviews where he kind of would be a little bit dismissive when people would mention that, rather than the current thing he was trying to promote. I remember reading, and I don't know how accurate it was or not, that he had turned down an offer to do a fourth one earlier on, like circa 87.
Oh, really?
But I read that in like in a genre magazine, not in, you know, Variety or anything that might be a bit more authoritative.
Matt, for somebody who wasn't even alive when the first three movies had come out, you were obviously aware of this series when you got to be in your teens. Did you think we would ever see another Mad Max film?
No, and I attribute it more to George Miller's age than anything else. Not to make myself sound like an elitist or an ageist by any means, but you got a guy pushing 70... coming back to a franchise after 30 years, and unlike the mid-80s, these big action films have gotten much more effects-driven in a technological way. Everything from stunt work to the use of integrating computer effects. Certainly practicality has kind of gone out the window for the sake of convenience. So I just wondered if this had passed him by and if he'd be able to make something that was both deserving of its inclusion in this series, but also making sure that it would please modern moviegoers and their sensibilities. And we even talked about this on another franchise we'll be covering very soon that we've already recorded. Moviegoers are much different nowadays than they are in the late 70s and early 80s. And we've seen a lot of properties try to come back with either too much time having gone by so nobody cares, or they feel so updated that they lose sight of their inception. So I never thought this would come out.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who wasn't even a fan of Mad Max when they initially came out. After Thunderdome, like, this was out of my mind. There were so many other things that were coming out, including with Mel Gibson, who had won an Oscar at this time, and George Miller had also moved on. You know, it should be said that 2 years after this had come out, he did Witches of Eastwick, which I watched this week for the first time, and my God, is that movie unwatchable.
I actually really liked that movie.
Oh, that movie's terrible. Oh, God dang.
I haven't revisited it for a while, but I remember liking it an awful lot.
Really?
Yeah, but
I guess it's the first time schlong is used in a movie, which, okay, is something to be proud of, I guess. But I found it just really tedious to get through.
So there's a couple of things that sort of crop up in conversations about the years when George Miller wasn't making Mad Max films. There's one thing, and again, I see a lot of, I don't want to say misinformation about this online, but I think a lot of people have picked up on this one thing George Miller said and haven't fully processed the context in which he said it. So, have you ever heard of an actor called John Blake?
Is he related to... Actually, that's the character Joseph Gordon-Levitt played in The Dark Knight Rises, so no.
Okay, so there was an up-and-coming Australian actor called John Blake. I hope I haven't misremembered his name here, but he had been in... There had been a popular Australian miniseries about Australian troops in the First World War, I think called Anzacs, which also had Paul Hogan in it. And confusingly, this series was directed by the other George Miller, because I don't know if you've mentioned this, but in Australian cinema has or had two directors called George Miller.
I was aware of that, yeah.
Yes, and one of them is the visionary auteur, and the other is a guy. I don't want to dismiss him as a guy. He's passed on now. He did make The Man from Snowy River, which is great. I think the other George Miller has one terrific film and lots of other work that's fairly okay and some very good TV stuff. But this show, Anzacs, like, the lead was Paul Hogan, but one of the supporting actors was a young actor called John Blake, who was on the rise, so they say. But after rapping on the film The Light Horseman, he was involved in a road accident. An awful road accident that left him with almost no physical or visible physical injuries, but with irreversible brain damage, so he couldn't work again. He never spoke again, and the insurance claim for this went to trial. There was a trial.
Oh, wow.
And lots of people spoke about how John Blake was a star on the rise. Lots of people said the things you need to say to get the insurance company just to give his family and his dependents as much money as possible, yes? And one of those folks is the other George Miller, the Mad Max George Miller, yes? He spoke, and one of the things he said was that he had Blake in mind for the lead for a Mad Max TV show.
Oh, wow.
Now, this is in 86. Obviously, one would think if Kennedy Miller had been developing such a thing, losing one actor wouldn't stop them, because you're already trying to replace an iconic actor, right?
Yeah.
That wouldn't derail it. So it always struck me as, maybe this is Miller doing this guy and his loved ones doing a really decent thing, yes? You know, affirming the narrative that this guy was going to be a huge star, but then this tragedy happened. But I've seen it printed in lots of places that, oh yeah, there was going to be a Mad Max TV show in the 80s, and there's no evidence of that. There's nothing in the trades, there's nothing mentioned, you know. But there is...
Yeah, I didn't see anything about that.
There is, about 10 years later, there's talk of doing a Mad Max TV show. So in the wake of Xena and Hercules, and those shows being extremely successful, and those shows being syndicated action shows shot cheaply in the Southern Hemisphere, because... Australia, like New Zealand, where those shows were shot, its dollar was very low against the US dollar at that time. So Warner Brothers Television had been having discussions with Miller about making a TV show like that based on Mad Max, doing a sort of syndicated action show that would be that. And there are, to the extent that it had been developed at all, the idea was that it would be a slightly more clean-cut, more last half of Thunderdome version of Max. They do have weekly adventures, but also that he'd have this long-term goal of trying to rebuild his interceptor, an idea that carries over. And then this was announced. One name was rumored, but again, I never read this in the Hollywood Reporter. I read this in the British sci-fi magazine SFX, so take this with a pinch of salt. They claimed that Warners were kind of interested in pushing Bruce Campbell for the role.
Oh, Christ.
So,
my God.
That would either have been the greatest thing or the worst.
Yeah, definitely. From what I read was, they wanted to make this as far back as 1998, you know, is when they were finally moving forward. And Mel was attached. He was attached to star in this for a while there.
Yes.
They got as far as pre-production on it, and they were about to roll cameras, and what happens? 9/11.
Yeah.
So they scrapped their plans to film over there. And there were so many things. Like for example, they found a location they were really happy with. They were all set to shoot there at a place where it never rains. Then it rains and flowers bloom and that place gets destroys their set for that. And then, of course, Mel Gibson has his breakdown and he calls a cop sugar tits. He gets fired off the project. At one point, George Miller did want Heath Ledger in the role, and then he ended up obviously passing away. Matt, have you read this? At one point, they were going to make it animated?
All this is news to me. I have not done much digging in the production history. I, in fact, didn't realize this movie was being made until I first saw the trailer. So my my knowledge is as minimal as can be. So everything from Bruce Campbell to Heath Ledger to animation, this is one hell of a road to get here.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, it's one hell of a fury road. Mick, you'd heard that, right? That they were going to make this anime.
They were kind of at the one point when it seemed like this had completely stalled. They were going to make an anime version of this. They're going to do it as an anime, which, yeah, I don't think we need that. I don't think this would be as fun if it was literally vehicles smashing into each other.
Yeah.
If you read it, it's that great book, The Oral History of This, Blood and Chrome, is it called? The Oral History of the Fury Road is fascinating because it is.
Yep, I have that book, and I have excerpts that I'm going to get into when we get into the film.
And they talk about all of the actors who were auditioned or were considered for Max, and we dodged some bullets there. Jeremy Renner.
Yeah, he was a front runner for a while.
Yeah, an Armie Hammer?
I think Hollywood learned the hard way that Jeremy Renner is not a leading man, because remember when they tried to give him the Bourne franchise?
Oh, yes. It's also funny that two of the directors of the Twilight Zone, the movie, both got kicked off projects with Jodie Foster by Jodie Foster.
Was Joe Dante kicked off one?
Yeah, Joe Dante was supposed to direct Little Man Tate.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So.
Oh, that's interesting.
As I say, if I had a nickel, I'd have two nickels, etc. But it's interesting that it worked out that way, because Miller was going to take this to a couple of other studios at various points. At one point, it was going to be with Fox.
But he was able to get it going, and he finally ended up casting Tom Hardy. He cast Charlize Theron, and then he obviously, this is very famous, but originally he had written a script with Brendan McCarthy back in the 90s, and he ended up scrapping a lot of that and made this pretty much off storyboards. Now, that book, based on the making of this particular film, it shed a lot of light, because when we were gearing up for Furiosa's release, we had heard way back in 2015 that Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy did not get along on the set, to the point where Charlize Theron, at one point, she requested some protection from him. And I guess that stems from an incident that is detailed in the book where Charlize Theron gets up in her getup. She's one of these people who's an early riser. She's always the first to set. And she gets there, she gets her makeup on, she's hanging out in this rig, and they're waiting for Tom Hardy to come out of his trailer. Tom Hardy is not showing up on set. She's waiting. Production manager's like, "Do you want to go, Charlize? You want to go use the bathroom? She's like, "Nope, I'm staying right here till he gets here." 3 hours later, Tom Hardy shows up, and she just storms out of the rig. She gets in his face, and she says, "I want this cunt fined $200,000 for every minute we spent waiting for him." Just going off, and he gets in her face, and it turned really ugly. So what they ended up doing was they ended up hiring this producer, Denise DeNovi, who has actually worked with Tim Burton, to kind of mediate between the two. And eventually, they ended up they ended up tolerating each other to the end of the shoot. But this was a real tumultuous shoot. And you gotta say, man, just being in this desert, hell, I'm in a casino 8 hours a day. Sometimes it gets blazing hot in it, and I get freaking short-tempered. I couldn't imagine spending 6 months on the desert like this. My fiance has, her work has meetings in Tahoe. I go to those beaches. Just going through that sand drives me crazy if I can't get back in time. There are a lot of things about working in the sand and working in this desert that just blazes tempers, and the making of this was pretty bad. And Nicholas Hoult had a great quote in it where it felt like when they were in the truck that entire time filming those scenes, it was like two parents in the front arguing the entire time. Matt, you've heard about these stories, right?
After the fact, yes. It's not surprising, because between the heat, you're in a foreign environment. I mean, Charlize Theron's outfit is pretty extensive. That doesn't take 5 minutes to put on.
Yeah.
You got Tom Hardy, who's wearing multiple layers in 100-degree weather.
A mask.
So I can see why hostilities were as high as they were. And it kind of shows in the movie in certain parts.
Definitely.
It's the fact that it's not even Australia. They were shooting in Namibia.
Yeah.
Because A, cheaper, and B, on Thunderdome, they discovered that the lovely plains in the centre of Australia where they'd shot were too rocky to go faster than 40 miles an hour, so they'd kind of been looking for somewhere that looked like the Wasteland but wouldn't have that geographical quirk. So you could just go as fast as you wanted without domes pelting your cameras. And yeah. Namibia, Mick, apparently is that place.
Mick, you've heard about these stories, right? You heard about the behind-the-scenes tension here.
Yeah. I mean, I heard a couple of... I can't remember if I read this one in that book again or if I read it before the film came out. Remember one rumor that Tom Hardy had gone a bit too method and was siphoning fuel from other vehicles?
This I haven't heard.
Yes. I just sort of trying to sleep outside and going full method, which maybe you shouldn't do if you're playing this character. Maybe you should just acknowledge that civilization hasn't collapsed yet and you don't need to be that crazy.
Apparently playing Mad Max makes you go mad. But the movie, despite all these tensions, despite everything that was in their way, it's released in May of 2015. I remember seeing it a month ahead of time, and I was able to get a review out there, and I gave it a pretty positive review. But once the movie came out, I mean, this thing caught fire. I know people who went back to see this 5-6 times in theaters, and it was kind of a phenomenon in that year, and it was so popular that Oscars felt like they had to answer, so they nominated this movie for 10 awards. Of course, it won 6, all technical awards. Matt, was the success of this movie a surprise to you?
I had no idea this was going to have the run that it did and be accompanied by a cinematic orgasm over the internet with people just going apeshit about how good this movie was. And I heard the hype going in. So it had not only was I surprised that this movie came out, but I was kind of gobsmacked by the showering of praise, like this was the best action movie, some people were saying, ever made, almost immediately. And that's as high of a bar to climb as you can. So I didn't go in arms folded, but it did make me say, okay, what is it that is just making people go nuts about this? And then when I saw the movie, I loved it. Look, this is not going to be a movie I come at like Garrett is, where he throws out the O word. I didn't feel that way. When it came to a lot of the Oscar talk, I thought it was all warranted. And honestly, looking at the movies that were nominated that year, because I was curious, this one has had the most staying power. When we look back on movies that should have won Best Picture, I think that's a contributing factor. Annie Hall versus Star Wars. Which one has more staying power? Not just because of all of Woody Allen's nonsense. But I was surprised. I mean, when I went into that summer, I expected Age of Ultron to be the big movie that just kept playing and got the most praise. But this came out a couple weeks after that, and Max ran over the Hulk like he was driving a tank. In a lot of the internet. So I guess it goes to show, sometimes you don't know something's going to be great until it comes out. Because I saw the trailer, I'm like, this looks really fucking cool. But is this going to be one of those movies where all the cool stuff is in the trailer and the movie's just a glorified sizzle reel? Because we've seen plenty of those type of movies. And I've seen so many Mad Max knockoffs in the 30 years since that there was a part of me that wanted the old guy pushing 70 to show all these young kids how to make an action movie.
I put as much in my review. I said, leave it up to a guy in his 70s to show these action directors how to really do it. And you know what? And I, like I said, it was a very positive review, but I remember when it came out and it became the phenomenon it did, I did start using the O word because I thought, you know what? I remember it being pretty good. I don't remember it being this good, though. And everybody started heaping praise on it. And that's when I started throwing overrated, because I had seen it a month before. I didn't really think about it too much. And then when it came out and everybody talked about it, you could not log on to Facebook without somebody posting a picture of the guitarist or somebody just heaping a heap of praise on it. Mick, were you one of these people? Were you a huge fan of this when it came out?
When I first saw it in theaters, I almost didn't know how to process any of it. I wasn't sure what I thought of this film the first time I saw it. I kind of thought, well, this is an astonishing technical achievement, and I think I was trying to absorb the whole film rather than watch it. You know, I think I was constantly sort of landing on production design details or constantly overthinking how certain things might have been achieved. But I couldn't stop thinking about it, so I went to see it again, and then again. And both of those pushed this movie way up in my estimation. I don't think I fully got it the first time I watched it, because I was trying to unpick it rather than just sitting and watching it. I certainly understood the praise it received. I'm still astonished it exists at all.
Yeah, the fact that somebody would give Miller $150 million plus to make this blows my mind. I gotta be honest. There were rumors that the studio was threatening to shut the production down because they were seeing dailies of it and they were like, what the fuck are you doing, dude? He had to fight and fight and fight every step of the way.
It's funny that Warner Brothers threw such a hissy fit about this movie and tried to shut it down multiple times. Meanwhile, this is the same studio that made how many shitty DC movies around this time?
Those started up what?
I'm going back to like Green Lantern and
oh yeah,
stuff like that. I mean, wasn't Sucker Punch Warner Brothers?
Oh yeah.
I don't understand studio heads, and it goes to show that you can only get so much from dailies and just base footage, you know, because there's so much that goes into making a movie. You know, it's editing, it's the score, it's the art direction. So just seeing, you know, what is basically just test footage, when people look at dailies, there might be some modifications, but you gotta wait to see the finished product. Now, I do understand the apprehension. This was a big budget, a property that hasn't really been around in 30 years, but you can't course correct halfway through production like that. Once you commit, you just gotta let the guy make it, and if it bombs or doesn't go well, then you just throw up your hands and say, well, we tried. The one thing I didn't like was I was not a fan of the Tom Hardy casting. When I heard that. Now, my choice, not as big of a star, but I thought Joel Edgerton would have been perfect. Because if you look at him, he does have a resemblance to young Mel Gibson. He is Australian, and I think this would have been the role. I feel like Tom Hardy's too big for this role. And I know it's weird to say that about Mel Gibson, but Mel Gibson was unknown, basically, when he played Mad Max. This is coming out after Inception. I think he had played Bane already. The Revenant was about to come out. So Tom Hardy was, like, as big as he's ever been, both literally and physically. You see The Dark Knight Rises. But I would have liked to have seen someone a little less well-known, especially because you already have Charlize Theron, who's an Oscar winner, and a big get, so to speak.
All right, well, let's see if this movie's a big get. We start off, we get a rusted Warner Brothers logo, and we get a voiceover with Tom Hardy saying that his name is Max, and he was once a cop, a road warrior, searching for a righteous cause. He says that as the world fell, everyone was broken, and it was hard to know who was more crazy, him or everyone else. Couple things here. First of all, this answers the question of whether Hardy is playing a continuation of Mad Mel. Obviously, he is.
Yes, and everyone who says he isn't is an idiot and needs to stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. There's that theory that he's the feral kid.
Yeah, I heard that too. All right. And secondly, let's get our feelings of Hardy as Max out of the way. To me, when we see him in the mask later on, it gave me strange flashbacks to Bane. I feel he's about as good as Mel, but that doesn't really make him a good character. Again, this is a passive reactionary character, so that's not a knock. But did this really have to be a Mad Max film? Because this could have been anyone.
I think it does, but I have two thoughts. One, I wish he did not do the narration. Because, like I said, I like Max more as a mirror to look through this world, not necessarily the one telling the story. Now, having said that, I think Tom Hardy does a good job. But the people complaining that Max is barely in this movie and isn't the main character clearly have never really seen a Mad Max movie before.
Exactly, yeah. That's been his MO. And I've noticed that in going through these with you guys. He's not one who drives the story.
He drives in the story, but
he drives in the story, correct.
But yeah, like, I heard that complaint as soon as the movie ended, and I'm like, clearly the people complaining have not seen the previous movies and are just looking at this because Tom Hardy's top build, and he was coming off Batman, which made him a household name for a lot of people, even though 10 years before that he was in Star Trek Nemesis, which I can't wait to talk about at some
point. Oh, God.
Well, it's kind of interesting, the two things. If you go look at the original screenplay for Road Warriors, one of the things that Miller has described in that script is that Max is gaunt and has long hair and is bearded. And he didn't get either of those things in that movie. And we did get hair metal Max in the third film.
Yes.
But this is a scrawnier looking version of Hardy than usual. And yeah, he's certainly very hirsute. You know, this sort of seemed to signal to me that, well, okay, this is one of these situations where Miller is going to get almost everything he's ever wanted. You know, things that were budgetarily an issue with the previous films are now not going to be an issue. But there's one weird thing about this opening that I've never seen anyone comment on, ever, but it seems so clear to me that there's some kind of parallel happening. And I'm going to put it this way. The first thing we see Max do is stomp on that two-headed lizard and eat it. Yeah? No. Do you know another movie that begins with our hirsute hero who's about to be captured by the bad guys stomping on a reptile with his foot?
I can't think of one.
Big hit, dominated the discourse, big, big film. And there's kind of a link between it and these movies.
I'm at a loss. Matt, do you know?
I feel like this was a Final Jeopardy question last night.
Yeah. Okay, have you seen Passion of the Christ?
Oh, God. Jeez.
Because Mick. How Passion of the Christ starts, except Jesus doesn't eat the snake. But at the start of Passion of the Christ, when Jim Caviezel, a name I can only say with sort of weary resignation, Jim Caviezel, as Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, crushes a snake under the heel of his foot, yeah? And this is the biblical reference there to the book of Daniel and the promise that the Messiah will come and restore Eden.
Wow, I would not have made that connection. I haven't seen that movie since it was in theaters.
Yeah, good call. It's garbage.
Yeah,
but, it's garbage. Which it's garbage, and it hates Jewish people who very much like its director, Melvin Gibson.
Time to get my obligatory South Park reference in because they put that on full display when they made that episode. They cut to Kyle in the movie theater, and he's like mortified.
So it's interesting. I don't know, because we knew Gibson was attached to this, right?
For a while, yeah.
So was he lifting from this movie? Was this movie just referencing the same thing? Had Miller put this back in when Gibson was attached to try and really sell his crazy trad cat leading man to be on this venture?
Oh, what a connection.
Sense that there's a Passion of the Christ connection, because this movie has a lot to say about the inherent flaws of cultism and, you know, worship. The movie has a lot to say about God in general. So there's kind of an interesting spiritual connection, but I can't believe there's a literal one, because I've never seen Passion of the Christ. I'll put that up.
Oof. Stay away. We see Max standing by a mountainside and hearing a little girl asking, "Where are you?" as he stomps a two-headed lizard and eats it, as Mick mentioned. You know why I like this scene? It's because it illustrates beautifully that this total wasteland is completely inhabited by people who have been ravaged by radiation. Some have tumors at different places of the body. But this shows even the animals who inhabit it aren't safe, as this lizard has two heads.
This is the one that has the most of a nuclear fallout type of post-apocalypse. The other ones, it's more economic and environmental, not necessarily a nuclear holocaust. But here, I sort of look at it as, because Max is telling the story, in his head he imagines shit being crazier than it actually is presented as. So you can read, much like the other movies, you can read it in multiple facets.
Yeah, I guess the one weird thing about this opening as well is, and you know, the idea that ideas Miller has had in his head for quite some time finally come to fruition. There is one lost Mad Max project that nearly happened that we don't talk about, but there was meant to be a video game in the early 90s.
Was there really?
For the Sega, yeah. That got as far as Miller and the games designer working together and it being storyboarded, and being storyboarded by Ed Vero, Spielberg's guy, and the person who helped design Thunderdome. And there's two interesting elements in that game that didn't happen. And one of them is Max eating a lizard, and the other is his interceptor being rebuilt and being back again, that he's a new version of the interceptor.
Interesting. So he's had these visions forever.
So these ideas have kind of carried over and ended up in this movie. And the Mad Max game didn't happen, but the guy developing it took all of his ideas for how it was going to work and funneled them into, do you remember Sewer Shark?
Oh my god, yes.
So that was originally,
I do remember that game,
devised as a Mad Max game, and if you can imagine that, but on land.
Oh my god. The video game did happen. It came out about 6 months after this movie, or maybe 4 months after, actually. And from what I've heard, it wasn't that good. And I know people have complained about it, including George Miller, who said that he didn't like the ideas that they incorporated into the game. I don't remember hearing too many good reviews of it. And plus, Furiosa's missing from it, too. So
the game's weird. It was supposed to be made by Miller's company. Were supposed to be setting up a games division, and that kind of all fell apart. Mm-hmm. And they were supposed to be handling this. And then when this got into the major cost overruns and all of that, Warner's got jittery and handed all of the resources for that game over to another studio. The game has got lots of narrative elements and things that will crop up in this film and also the next film are present in the game, including some characters. But the game's made by French people who don't know what Australia looks like. So it's why its version of the Outback looks like Arizona. And why the voice acting's all wrong. It's just, it's kind of the I can't quite hack the game. I know lots of people like it, but I'm just life is full of Americans.
So you played it?
I've played it, yeah. It's what happens when you let French people make a Mad Max video game. I'm just going to say that. It's not necessarily bad. It's just they don't fully understand the material.
There go all our French listeners. Max gets in his car and drives off before getting tumbled by scavengers and haunted by those he could not protect. So let's get this out of the way. So throughout this film, We're going to get haunted visions and voices of kids, notably a girl who was saying Max wasn't there to protect them. Now, is this somebody from Thunderdome, or is this somebody we've never met? Because Miller never feels the need to explain it to us, and I find it annoying that we keep seeing and hearing them and have no idea where they're from.
Right. Well, there's two ways we can go about this. One is you can watch the film and accept that these visions are just sort of like manifestation of his guilt and his trauma. Or you can read the not very good prequel comics, came out around the same time as this, which filled in some of that material, and trust me, the answer to the question is bad. In the comics, the little girl's an actual little girl whom Max wasn't able to save.
Matt, did this bother you?
No, because I always subscribe to the show don't tell theory, and more importantly, I always get annoyed in movies and franchises where everything that's supposed to be important is exclusively the stuff you've seen in the movies. Not to connect it to Tom Hardy again, but Dark Knight Rises. Basically, the genesis of that movie is his entire tenure of Batman we have seen on screen. So, like, there's been nothing in between. In this, you can read it as he's had other adventures, or he's fucking insane, and he's just seeing hallucinogenic visions that are just representations of his repressed guilt, to Mick's point. So, I am perfectly fine with how this is depicted.
Because Miller has never been a narrative storyteller, so he's not going to explain this.
These movies don't, and you know, preoccupied with continuity. They've never been, and I think this is a good testament to you don't have to be entirely linear with your storytelling for these movies to still work. Not everything has to be spoon-fed to you.
See, here's what I bumped into when we did those first two movies, and to a certain extent the last film too. In fact, to a lot of extent, is I was looking for narrative. I was looking for a story to make us care. What I've realized in doing this retrospective with you guys is that is not Miller's forte. Miller's forte is he is an artist, and he is going to tell this story by having them go through these experiences and having you experience these things with them. So when I got past that, I was able to get past the O word that I had mentioned for this movie and go along with it. And yes, I do have plot points. I do have things that he has outlined for this movie, but it's not about that. And I tell you, it took me a while to get to understand that. But man, the more I watch these movies and the more I get into this one, I'm with you guys. I don't need this, but it did kind of bug me that we're just seeing these flashes and not knowing where they're from. But we're here to feel the character with Miller, not necessarily understand it. So we're hearing Max say that now he just exists in this wasteland and he's taken hostage. And then, Matt, we're getting the obligatory cutting of the hair scene as he's also getting branded. And I saw Road Warrior when he was getting branded. So, again, more continuity.
Mm-hmm. There's also a day where you see the calendaring system that the bad guys in the Citadel are using.
Uh-huh.
And it's not years, it's days. So it's something like day 30,000. It's something insane.
Yeah.
I can't see how that would be practical, but okay. It stops him having to put in a definite calendar year in this movie.
He then fights his way out. And I never really saw Max as a fighter. He did a little bit in Thunderdome, but he's doing more of it here. He's being chased down as he climbs his way up. He sees the girl again and runs through corridors. He runs through some bad morphs. This is one thing I really didn't like, is how Miller was big in the press when this movie had come out, saying there's barely any CGI here. But when we see these morphs, it's pretty bad, and it kind of takes me out of it.
Oh, no, I like them, because they're not clean.
Do you?
They're not doing the classic... Well, because I'm old, I think my classic morph reference is always the That Godly and Cream video, which I think is the first...
Oh, God.
Yeah, I think it's the first time people saw morphing faces. It's not that. It's the fact that it kind of goes from skulls with hollowed-out eyes to these faces that there's about maybe three or four steps in it. It happens so quickly, and it feels hallucinatory. I never thought it felt like a cheap morph to me. I always thought, oh, that's actually quite effective. That's a strange, unsettling, hallucinatory image, especially when the little girl's face goes all scully. Yeah, I like that.
I think it adds to the perspective that this movie is basically a nightmarish hellscape, because the imagery is very dreamlike, and how images will just pop up out of nowhere. Because this movie is like the definition of a fever dream mixed with just an injection of Jolt Cola and Red Bull for 2 hours. This thing just fucking goes. And not to gloss over the hand-to-hand combat, in a movie that's this big in scope and visuals, I like that he actually kind of starts small. The movie is 90% vehicular crashes and stunt work, but I like how it's old-fashioned brawling. It's the equivalent of starting up an engine.
Yeah.
You rev it up at full force, then the rest of the movie, it doesn't feel like you're escalating. If you blow your load early, then sometimes you can't carry that propulsiveness through the rest of the movie. So I like how this starts out. And much like the previous movies, Max is not Superman. He can be hurt. He can be beat up. He can be tied up to someone that you look at and go, you lost to this guy? He's kind of got that Indiana Jones thing.
Max gets outside where the green is. He gets on a hook before he's pulled right back in, and the title fills the screen. So this is our whole entire pre-title sequence, and it's pretty intense.
Yeah.
We cut to a character we're going to know as Furiosa, walking away from the camera as a brand on her shoulder is shown. So Charlize Theron was a new mother when she took this part. She had won an Oscar 12 years before. Now she's taken on this ravaged role where she has her head shaved, which was her idea, by the way, and is going to be hanging around in this desert for months. It must have been miserable, and in the years since, Miller, to his credit, says he was paying more attention to how the character was affected and not the actor, and if he was making this movie today, he would have been more empathetic toward her and Hardy and the shit that they had going on between them. Now, we talked about the feud between the two stars. We talked about Hardy. How do we feel about Theron here in the role of Furiosa?
Oh, she's great. She's sort of immediately occupying this role, and yeah, there's just something very magnetic about her on screen, especially in this role. She has a strange poise. There's just terrible thing that sometimes happens when it's looking at performances. I think the worst example in recent memory is when they were talking about Margot Kidder in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where they thought that small number of lines meant she was an integral presence in the film, even though she's in many, many scenes acting physically, or we're following her. And it's this idiotic thing I think some journalists do, where they think, because our profession hinges on word counts, actors must want to have lots of words to say. And this feels like a performance where nothing the character says is superfluous. And
yeah, every word she has an impact. I agree with
you. Yes. And the script is also paring all of that back, and Theron is just feels coiled, ready to pounce, and sort of dangerous, but also really magnetic. It's extraordinary. You know, we talk about people having star quality, and it's hard to define, and sometimes you usually just have to go, watch this Cary Grant movie, or look at that performer there, or that thing they're doing. It's impossible to define, really, but Theron has it here.
Nick, you meant Margot Robbie, right? Not Margot Kidder?
Oh, God, yeah. Sorry, Margot Kidder would have been... Who's even called Margot? I mean, just, you know, is that even a real name? Have you met a Margot ever in real life?
So, good catch, God, Matt. Yeah.
Margot Kidder was, of course, amazing, and I
think one of the reasons why this character and this movie's very pro-feminist approach had the staying power and the resonance it did was, if you remember around this time, you know, mid-2015, Hillary Clinton was gearing up for her presidential campaign. There was a sentiment about quality and better representation in the workplace, independent of filmmaking. And people were becoming much more fed up with government oppression. And there was this brewing sense of these studio films having to be a bit more of a spark than your usual flair. And if you notice, as you talked about, every word she says has meaning and importance. And the movie doesn't feel the need to have her come out and say, because I'm a woman. The movie never has to literalize through dialogue. It's all through showing and imagery. A lot of the dialogue is very blunt. But this movie also does have the messaging of a sledgehammer. It's just in a different way than most people are accustomed to. Like, this is not Captain Marvel, where they literally play just a girl during a big action scene, and it makes you just want to, like, squirm in your seat because it's so blunt. And look, other blockbusters have done nuanced female characters, and it's the ones everyone talks about. Ripley, Sarah Connor, mostly those two. Those are the only ones people can think of. But those movies move at a more sedative pace than this one does. So because of that, everything Furiosa stands for and what the wives stand for, which we'll talk about, it's all through a much quicker pace and through action and some of the camera work, not necessarily dialogue. There's no long speeches in this movie, thank God.
Yeah, she never expresses her motivation. And I like how Miller keeps it that vague. We get her motivation just by her actions. Again, that just goes to Miller's way of story of telling stories, and that he's not going to tell you, he's going to show you.
Yeah. Well, it's the exact same way Max was portrayed in the previous movies, where in like the in the Road Warrior, he's just doing it to survive. He doesn't really need to explain himself. He just says, I'm here for the gasoline, even though he saved people. He comes back, but they're never like, why did you come back? And he never says, because I needed to do something right. Like, he doesn't have to explain it in that context, and neither does she.
What's weird is, you know, I remember when this movie was out, people were saying, well, Furiosa stole the role from the title character. If you notice, the title says Fury Road. I think that is very intentional, and I think he was kind of making this a Furiosa movie without calling it a Furiosa movie, which we're going to get next week. So we see Furiosa put a steering wheel on this war rig, which is headed to Gastown as Emoten Joe. He has his bodysuit put on. Matt, is it just me, or does this remind me of Darth Vader?
Oh, yeah, he's the Motorhead equivalent of Darth Vader, but this is a very provocative look.
Definitely.
I think this is one of the best designed villains we've had in a mainstream movie in a very long time that was not based on a comic book.
Correct.
Because this feels straight out of like something you would read in like Hellboy or even something like Spawn. I mean, even it's kind of like Bane because he's got the breathing apparatus. But when he speaks, I'm not smirking because I don't find the voice inherently funny.
Yeah, and Mick, am I right? This is Toe Cutter from
Hugh Keith Barron, who was going to be Martian Manhunter in Miller's abandoned League film. Yeah, which would have been interesting. Because he's a fascinating actor, and it's sort of a shame that, the issue with the Mad Max films is you do run out of interesting Australian character actors. Actually, you've made a couple of these, and there's some recycling, but this isn't an actor he could have brought back in any of the previous films. Without it being confusing, but the fact that decades have passed and also his face is obscured means I'm watching this movie, but I'm not thinking, oh, Toe Cutter. So it's a really nice piece of character design. I also like the fact that when we're seeing him getting prepared and being dressed, and we're seeing that he's old and saggy, you know, and tumorous.
Yeah, as everybody is in this movie.
But the fact that he's being kind of strapped into this plexiglass armor that's sculpted with perfect pecs. to try and give the impression that he's still ripped and virile and all of that. And I love this a lot. Also, it's every dictator and strongman ever has done this right. Been in their corset or they've got their jacket full of the military medals on it they haven't really earned. You know, all of that stuff is here. God, with the design work, so much fun. Did you notice, you know, when Emoten Joe's about to do his big speech, we kind of see the sort of panel of trinkets in front of him? And there's two things that are amusing. One is, there's one of the badges for the police force from the first film.
Oh, I didn't know.
There's the main force patrol badge, sorry, yes. And there's also a Tesla.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a little sort of a thing scraped off the side of a Tesla. A thing that felt like a sly joke in 2015, but now feels hysterical in 2024.
Yeah.
That joke's aged very well.
That's funny. So, Emoten Joe, he salutes his Imperator, Furiosa, and he proclaims himself as the Redeemer, as the crowd chants. He then turns on the water, which is pretty much going to waste here. He tells them to not become addicted to water. It will take hold of you. And then we see the war rig take off. We cut to Max, who's still in captivity, as he's being called a universal donor. And then we go back to Furiosa as she veers off the beaten path. She's pursued by the other cars, and she says she's headed east. And then we cut to some mother's milk being taken and then drank by Emoten Joe and his son. This was, man, you talk about a crazy scene here that really got a reaction in theater I saw it in. Boy, this is...
Oh, yeah.
This will surprise you if you don't expect it.
Rictus Rectus is just such a fantastic character, and I love him.
Yes.
I love
me too.
I love Emoten Joe's large adult son.
Yeah, played by Nathan Jones, who was a wrestler for a while there. In WWE,
I like the fact that he's kind of like the roided up post-apocalyptic Eric Trump. You know, he's the most useless feels unimaginable, but I guess the fact that he's large and strapping means no one can do anything about it.
There's parts of this movie that border on being so disgusting you have to look away.
Yeah, for sure.
But it goes to show how primal this world has become, where we are back to, there is medicine, but even that is very rudimentary, and I doubt there is such a thing as baby formula in this world. But it's very upfront, much like the other movies, with how disturbing parts of it are. A lot of the gross stuff is very matter-of-fact, like how the violence is in The Road Warrior, as an example.
Yeah, this is something you would not expect to see in a blockbuster film released in the summer. I respect the balls of the studio to actually go through with this and let this vision come to pass, because you're right, this is not a world you want to be in. I want to give an example. You watch those Fast and Furious movies, it looks fun to be in those cars and doing those huge stunts and everything they do in those films. Here, it does not look fun. And this is just an example of how repulsive George Miller is making this world. And I'm not saying that in regards to the women. I'm just saying, in total, everybody in this movie, like I mentioned, is just beaten down by the nuclear war that has come before them. I respect that Miller was able to do this. So Joe is told that Furiosa has gone off the path, and then he is told that you cannot own a human being and that she is taking the rig a long way from you.
Yes. Here's what's interesting to me. When he stomps into the little part of the Citadel where he kept his wives, and he's been threatened by their teacher, yes, and she has a shotgun, and it's the second time in the franchise where Hugh Keith Byrne has been threatened by a defiant old lady with a large double-barrel shotgun.
Yeah, I thought of that. I had flashes of that as I was watching this, and I would never have caught that if I wasn't doing this with you guys.
Yeah, it's funny that just the same image has just come around again, sort of.
We then meet Nux, played by Nicholas Hoult, who's informed that Furiosa took the breeders from Joe, and I'm liking this wall of steering wheels that's here. Not only that, I reread my review of this going into this particular recording, and in my review, I did point out that Nicholas Hoult kind of steals every scene he's in. I do, in rewatching this, love him in this movie. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah, really, really good in this film. I think he's maybe got the most interesting character arc as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, and to the point, I didn't even realize that was him
for
the longest of time, because I had only seen him in the X-Men movies and About a Boy, but that was like, what, 15 years before this? So.
And Warm Bodies, that was the other thing I'd seen him in.
Oh, that's right. I've still never seen that. He's the closest this movie has to any sense of comic relief.
Definitely.
Without going too overboard. This very easily could have been the... He could have been the Joe Pesci from Leo Get, where he
veers, Lethal Weapon.
He veers too far into just yucks.
Yeah, no, Joe Pesci in Lethal Weapon 2 is fine. I think the worst you could have with this would be Rob Schneider in Judge Dredd.
Oh, shit!
He has the worst fucking Judge Dredd. Somebody who isn't even funny, ever.
One other thing I wanted to mention, Matt, is one thing we talked about when we did the original Star Wars movies last year was that the world George Lucas originally conceived of was so vast that there were characters with backstories that you couldn't possibly know unless you dug deeper into the canon. I feel like Miller has created a similar world here. There are so many ravished characters with so many backstories that I would read comics based on this world, although according to Mick, they're not very good.
Yeah, they're bad.
I'll give an example. Let me give an example. So I read an interview with the guy who plays the infamous guitarist in this movie, and he said the reason he is wearing this dress and this mask is because his mom was killed when he was a little boy, and these are actually hers. These are the kinds of cinematic worlds that I love, and was something I definitely did not appreciate when I originally saw this movie back in 2015.
Yeah, no, it's the idea that if you let your characters and your actors inhabit the characters and give them all detailed backstories and also cool names, your actors will be happier and will do more work. And it's kind of funny. One thing I like about these movies is the way most of these supporting characters, even if they're only in one scene or of a line or two, have got cool names. I'm always telling students, you know, because they're always trying to make short films and they never have money to pay actors, I'm always telling them, don't hire an actor and expect them to play man number two. Don't do that. Give the character a name or a more interesting description. So when that person's trying to get extra work and showing casting agents their resume, well, it's something cool sounding on it, yes. This is the best example of that. There's no small roles in these movies.
Yeah, every character has a reason for being there. So that's more than I could say for a lot of these big series.
Nux says that if he's going to die, he's going to die historically on the Fury Road. We cut to a set of cars with Max strapped to the grill of one and Flame shooting from another as the guitar plays as if it's part of the world and not part of the soundtrack.
Yeah, and here's the thing. This is the point where I see a lot of people get lost, because a lot of people can't follow things unless the exposition is spoon-fed to them. But the sort of mechanism here is that the War Boys are almost all suffering from radiation-induced cancers and are not long for this earth, and that's why they're referred to as half-lives. And that one of the things that can arrest this is blood transfusions, and that's why it's important that Max is a universal donor, why we're told that early on, and why he's strapped to the car, because Nux is getting a transfusion for Max whilst taking part in this chase, which is
yes.
kind of madness I like.
We see Furiosa pursued by vehicles from the Citadel, as she says, they're just on detour. And I do love these buzzards, these spiked vehicles. This is one of many great action scenes in this movie, and these vehicles are just a part of it. They're really great.
All the design work in this movie is impeccable. I think on a technical level, this is as good and as well-crafted a big action movie as you'll find.
Yeah, no, I love all of the design work in this. And this is actually a thing where I think this is a big step up from Thunderdome, where fun design work overall, but I don't think there's a vehicle from Thunderdome apart from the cog car that you could show me a picture of and I'd immediately recognize, other than in a sort of generic, oh, that looks a bit like a vehicle that would have been in. Whereas with this, all of the vehicles are iconic and awesome looking.
Oh, yeah.
Each of these could be a toy.
We see cars flip as people fly and the buzzards getting flamed by spears thrown at them. Again, just great stuff here. We have a great overhead shot of the other vehicles as the guitar just keeps playing. Max is right in the middle of it as spears go over his head and the spikes get ultra close to taking him out. We see some war boys spray chrome spray paint on them because they worship the V8 engines and they feel they must die looking like they're made from metal. Boy, what a world fucking Miller has crafted here.
Do you know the inspiration for this? For the war boys criming their mouth?
No, I was going to ask
you
about it.
Okay, it's great because it's bonkers because it's influenced two crazy works of art. There was I think it came out in the 70s, there's a great Australian documentary about the Vietnam War, where this Australian film crew are following Viet Cong fighters. And one of the things they do in that film is, they have these little silver ornaments of Buddha, even, and they put them in their mouth, kind of holding that in their cheeks. It's kind of a good luck thing, so that they're holding this good luck token, but not using their hands before they go off to fight. And that inspired the chroming in this. And it also inspired a absolutely bonkers but great Kate Bush song called Pull Out the Pin, because she saw the same documentary and wrote a song about the Viet Cong, and that detail is also in it. So I like the idea that two idiosyncratic people who kind of never stopped being awesome saw the same thing and both thought, yeah, that's crazy. I'm going to make something from that idea I've seen somewhere else.
That is amazing, because from Star Wars to a movie me and Matt are going to get to pretty soon, Aliens, there are movies throughout that are really inspired by Vietnam, and now you're saying that this movie in 2015 was also inspired by Vietnam. It's funny how these old school filmmakers go to that well, which, again, I'm not knocking it for it. It's just that war has inspired a lot of great art, no matter how tragic the war actually was. We have a great shot of this guy flying right into the car. We're getting introduced to Splendid as she crawls to the other side of the truck, and Furiosa and Max, they make eye contact for the first time. Splendid tells Furiosa that they can't breathe down there as a saw blade comes dangerously close to hitting Furiosa. They then drive right into a dust storm, and holy shit, what a visual this is. Probably my favorite visual of this entire movie is them going into this storm.
This is where one of those times you need to watch this on the biggest screen possible.
Yes.
This is one of the movies where if I see you watching this on your phone, I'm going to slap it out of your hand. There's just certain movies that are made to be watched on the largest screen possible, and this is probably in the top 10.
Yeah, you just took the fire out of my final summation, because that's what I was going to say for sure.
Well, it's kind of an extension as well. There's a little bit in Thunderdome of the idea that the desert's dangerous and you can be sucked into it, and that you can get lost in sandstorms, but there's nothing on this scale. And it actually kind of reminds me of, do you know the science fiction book, Damnation Alley? It's this kind of classic late 60s, very pulpy science fiction book from which lots of things have drawn inspiration. It's set in a post-nuke North America, where Boston and Los Angeles are the only cities left, and everything in between is an irradiated wasteland, and this former Hell's Angel is press-ganged into driving this heavily armored truck to take an antiviral serum, from Los Angeles to Boston. But all the way through it, the desert, there's continuing theme that the weather will kill you. That there's bits in it where people's vehicles get pulled up into storms and you never see them again.
And it sounds interesting.
Yeah. It was a terrible actual film adaptation of Damnation Alley in 77 from 20th Century Fox, who thought it was going to be their big hit that year. You should never watch it. It's bad.
Meanwhile, Max makes his way out of his constraints and fights his way back to the back of the car as Furiosa rams the car and Max goes flying. We cut to the aftermath as Max rises out of the sand and struggles to get out of his restraints. He makes his way to the rig, carrying the other half of his restraints with him. He finds Furiosa with the wives outside the rig. And here we go.
This fight scene is great visual storytelling because if you notice, the water hose has already been established. And you don't think it's going to come into play as a weapon, but it actually does. And, yeah. it does a lot. This shows how to incorporate disparate elements into a singular action scene. Like, there's the water hose. There's the established shotgun that misfires. There's the shot where you don't realize she's pregnant until the camera actually shows it. This is why George Miller is a master of his craft. He knows where to draw your eye. He knows how to establish things without literally telling you. This fight scene is as primal as anything we've seen in the Mad Max movies, where it's him fighting a woman of all things, and this would not have carried over well if it was still Mel Gibson.
No.
Thank God
it wasn't him during this part.
And the editors who did this, they got really uncomfortable editing this scene because they felt that they were really going at it, which they probably were.
Yeah, but it's a great fight scene. And it's also got, again, the thing Miller keeps talking about in interviews is how digital techniques allowed him to do things that he'd always wanted to do or had always done but allowed them to do them more fully. And in all of these films so far, there have been scenes where the action is, well, the technical term is undercranked, where it's sped up a little. Instead of shooting at 24 frames a second, he's shooting at maybe 18 or 16 frames so that when it's played back, the motion appears faster. And there's some of that here in this fight scene, and it's great. It really works. It establishes kind of a sort of sense of intensity and immediacy, despite it being such a distracting and unreal technique. It also takes us closer to silent cinema, which there's a lot of in this film that feels, well, that is drawn from silent cinema. So I like that a lot. And I like that so many of the environmental things, like Matt said, are in this fight and come into play. It feels a little bit like what always happens in sort of Jackie Chan films, where everything in the environment gets used or has a purpose in the fight.
Yeah, I thought of Jackie Chan a bit too. And Mick, you just kind of touched on something I was going to ask you about later, but I'll go ahead and get to now. It's true. This movie was what, about 60%, 24 frames per second? Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, most of it is, but a lot of it isn't. There's lots of bits where he's either for like emotional effect or to better sell a piece of action, he's going down to a lower frame rate. And it's great. It's fantastic. It's a thing.
Yeah.
It's a thing people are afraid to do because they're worried that it will look goofy. But I guess, you know, this was shot by John Seale, one of the greatest cinematographers ever. You know, the technical control here is incredible. I can't imagine somebody trying this and it going badly wrong. But for Miller, it worked.
Now let's talk about one of these wives. We have Rosie Huntington here, who, like everyone in this shoot, was just miserable on the set. She made her money around this time being a supermodel, and she had to shave her eyebrows for this movie, and that kind of destroyed some of her work afterwards. She didn't really capitalize on this like I thought she would, and I thought she was pretty good here for the small amount of screen time that she's here. Definitely compared to Transformers 3, which she was also in and also had a horrible time in.
Well, Matt? Because George Miller actually respects women.
Yeah.
Well, he does, but she was still miserable here.
Yeah, but... I think this goes to show the importance of directors with working with people who are not trained actors. Because Michael Bay shoots her entirely like she is a supermodel. And it makes sense that she was in that movie because clearly she transformed those boobs at one point in her life. Whereas here, she can deliver her lines. She's got a certain amount of protectiveness that you actually buy as she's like the leader of these wives by default.
So we have this fight that you guys have already detailed, but Max ends up taking down Furiosa as we once again hear the guitar in the background. Max gets in the rig and drives off. Furiosa catches up to him and says that she set up kill switches and the rig goes nowhere without her and the mothers. She finally gets him to cave when she asks, "Do you want that thing off of your face?" And that's the breaking point. Go ahead.
Does Tom Hardy have a mask fetish?
I don't know. Because in his blockbusters, he seems to wear them a lot.
It's also a useful thing when you're recasting a character in a franchise. Maybe if you can obscure their face for as much as possible.
That's a good point, too.
Do you remember the opening to Living Daylight? They don't show us the new Bond right away. It could be any one of these guys on this mission.
Matt, you know those movies.
Yeah, that's the one that opens Garrett with them on the training exercise where they all jump out of the plane.
Okay. All right, yeah.
And I don't think we see Timothy Dalton as Bond until a little bit into that sequence. I kind of feel like the same thing is happening here. By the time Max actually gets the mask off, you're like, oh, all right, it's Max. I'll buy it, you know.
Furiosa takes the wheel and they take off, but not before Nux catches up. they look and they find the Gastown boys complete with the people eater. Again, this is Miller just not even naming people, just kind of calling them names.
But everything you need to know about the people eater, you knew from the fact that he's called the people eater. And
exactly.
And he's a corpulent person in a world of scarcity, so you know you can put all you can glue that all together yourself. They don't need to explain what his deal is.
Max tells Furiosa that he'll go back and investigate what they're dragging as he reconnects the fuel pod. And then 46 minutes in, he finally gets the mask off. Nux makes his presence known in the rig as now bullet farmers are in pursuit. And I just love the look on Max's face because he just kind of looks like, what the hell have I found myself into? He is involved in this huge rig going across this land. And again, he doesn't pursue these things. They just kind of find him.
Yeah, he just wanders into another story.
Yes.
Which is the calling card of all of these sequels, where he just is a unwilling participant that just jumps off the page into something that he does not want to be involved in. And for all intents and purposes, it's very coincidental that he just happens to be captured at the same time as Furiosa's prison break.
Again, yeah, I never understood the complaints that Max is a secondary character because that's his job. He falls into these situations that are more interesting than he is. I think there's a certain type of viewer, and it's almost always a guy, who can't stand the idea that the guy isn't the central figure in a narrative. It sort of breaks their brains. I think I've forced a lot of people to sort of deliberately misunderstand the point of this movie and the point of the other movies, and I think often the point of all movies at one time or another.
Yeah, and you know what? I can't play ignorant here. I was one of those people. I was one of those people who just did not get the fact that these movies were named after somebody who was the least interesting part of the movies. You know, I've even said that in these previous podcasts. But I'm going to go ahead and say, like I said, I see it now. I see what Miller's doing. He's putting this character in, and next week he's not even here. So I do find it great that I have found another artist in my life that I didn't notice before. Nux once again finds his way out of the rig. Furiosa tells the wives to get back in the hold, but Max tells Splendid to stay. Furiosa tells Max that he cannot be seen as he also gets in the hold, and then she pulls up in the rig. She asks him his name, and he replies with, "It doesn't matter." This will become something that we refer to again later on. Furiosa stops the rig and says that she's going to unhitch, but she's called out on how much company she has with her, and she gives a signal, and Max hits the gas, and they drive off. Furiosa pulls herself into the rig, and we get one of my favorite action scenes of this movie. This chase and gunfight is fucking glorious.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's so good. It's, again, it's Miller thinking about action in not just on the X and Y axis, but on the Z axis as well. That stuff is happening above and below. I love that so much, and I love that his approach to action cinema is so focused on those possibilities.
Just these motorcycle guys, like, flying up and dropping these grenades, these stunts. We have Furiosa shooting them, and we have guys falling off the bikes. Again, more stunts. It's just great stuff, and you got to look at it as art. This is George Miller at his finest, is right here.
Watching this in a theater, I turned to my friend, and I'm like, I'm so happy to be here right now. Because I gotta say, like, I was thinking in my brain when I was sitting here watching this going, I haven't felt this much of a groundbreaking level of action since the first Matrix. Now, this isn't inventing a new form of action like bullet time. This movie's very colorful, like very bright blues and oranges mixed with really fast editing, but you could still tell what's happening. Like, it feels new because so many blockbusters to me felt the same around this time with, like, Transformers and a lot of the big ones at the time. This felt like the old man saying, I'll show you kids how to do it. And I think he put a lot of people to shame watching this. And then because of this movie, a lot of people tried to make this to very lesser degrees.
Like any successful movie, sometimes imitation is not always flattery. So Rictus eventually shoots a harpoon into Max's hand as Splendid is taken underneath the rig, and it's Max's decision to not go after her because in his mind, she's dead and she went under the wheel.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because it's Splendid goes under the wheel because she wants to prove herself because she didn't know how to load the gun. In the fire, during the gunfight when Furiosa hands her the bags and tells her, reload this, and she doesn't know how to do it, so she wants to do something to prove herself. But Splendid also probably wouldn't have slipped if she didn't have that trickle of blood running down her leg because she got injured during the fight earlier on between Max and Furiosa when Max fired the gun and the bullet scraped her leg. It's an interesting point here. she's doing all of this because that those two things happened to her. And then Max isn't going back because, well, he says he's certain he saw her go under the wheels, but there's ambiguity there, right? And we have to assume that this is another thing that Max will feel guilty about if he's even thought about the chain of events.
I did not pick up the fact that she slipped because she was trying to prove herself.
Yeah, she was doing the
after not loading. I did see the scene where she's trying to load her gun and the other one just takes the gun and says, no, I'll do it. But that led to this, huh?
Yeah. She's trying to do something save everyone, which is why she kind of opens the door and kind of she knows that the Immortan Joe won't shoot her because he's her favorite. And so she's his favorite and she is with child. And there is a series of causal chains here, which is a thing I think people miss because they're not all immediately spelled out to us by people saying, oh, she did this because, you know, it's it. We're following the action if you're watching this properly rather than having characters stop and tell us why this character behaved that way. You know, the exposition is all in the action.
So one of the wives, she wants to go back to Joe, but the other wives stop her. Max asks Furiosa where the green place is, and she says that she's going down to do some repairs. We see that Nux has once again made his way back onto the rig, and he says that he should be in the Valhalla, and he goes on about how he feels guilty and mortal. Meanwhile, the wives count their remaining ammo, and I like how Miller has colored this. Max and Furiosa, they're in the blue filter, while the wives are in color. And, you know, I have to say something here, boys. You know, when this movie came out on Blu-ray, they did do a black and white version of it. I know it's called Black and Chrome.
Yes.
But that makes zero sense, because in addition to the action, in addition to all the stunts that Miller does here that's extraordinary, this movie's power is that it uses color better than any blockbuster I've seen in recent memory, and taking that away is fucking blasphemy to me. I've never watched those black and white cuts, I never will, because of how well George Miller uses color here.
Yeah, I've never watched it either. I've watched bits of it in black and white, and it always feels like something vital is being withheld.
The rig gets stuck in some mud as Max sets some charges. They get back on the road as Immortan Joe he finds Splendid, and they struggle to save his child with a C-section. So Max was wrong. She was not dead.
Oh, but I think she seemed pretty dead. I think the child...
I think the idea is that the child
might still be retrievable.
She wasn't breathing? I thought she was breathing. So she wasn't breathing when they picked her up?
I don't think so. I mean, I think she seemed in a... Well, we need to ask the organic mechanic. And look at his nose.
And my God, when they pulled this knife out and sharpened the blades, that's some disturbing imagery. Again, just stuff you don't see in a blockbuster like this.
No. To the extent that I'm kind of always worried of recommending this film to some people I know who've had trouble conceiving.
Oh, God, Mick, what are you doing? What are you thinking?
Well, no, I mean, I'm just kind of like, I'm just like, this film does lean heavily into some of those anxieties for like a big blockbuster.
Rictus is told that he lost a baby brother who was perfect in every way. The rig gets once again stuck in mud as Nux once again climbs aboard. He's just back and forth here. Max misses with what remaining ammo they have, so Furiosa takes the rifle and hits a direct shot, which was a great moment.
They're firing the shot to take out the big searchlight that the bullet farmer has on his vehicle. And this is the thing that blinds the bullet farmer, so the bullet farmer is now blind. And it's completely the Odyssey. It's a Ulysses blinding the Cyclops.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's very much a reference to that, which I appreciate.
I mean, look, there's a lot of mythology. I mean, Valhalla is straight out of Viking lore.
Yeah.
So I like that he's pulling from myth. There's a lot of Western culture, but there is a good chunk of Eastern philosophy, if you know about the importance of nature that we'll talk about with the seeds.
There's one big myth, and I swear I'm going to just not point out all the myths in this, but there's one big one here that, again, I've not seen people discuss, but it seems so obvious to me. And I read a research paper on this the other day, where they figured it might be the oldest human myth. Do you know the story of the Seven Sisters? It's this mythic story that basically is in every culture on Earth. So they figure we must be telling this story or a version of it for at least 100,000 years. And it's basically like the best known version is the one in Greek myth, where the Seven Sisters were the daughters of Atlas, but they were pursued by Orion the Hunter, who wanted to rape them, so that Zeus turned them into stars and they went up in the sky so they would be safe from him. But every version of the story is the tale of a woman being pursued by a male predator. God, we're great humans. This is our oldest story. But,
wow.
Yeah, here's the thing, right? But this gets me every time. So this story is also told by Aboriginal Australians. The versions of the story, it is everywhere. And it strikes me that this film is also maybe a version of this. Miller has said he originally wanted to have seven wives, but backed out of that because he wouldn't be able to fit them all in the truck. So, Garrett, you saw Witches of the East recently, yes?
Yes.
There's a movie in which a bunch of wives don't want to be wives to the terrifying dark god anymore, who's an embodiment of the patriarchy.
Literally the devil.
Literally Satan, and they flee from him, yes. That film ends with them fleeing from him, destroying him while he's trying to catch them, and then seizing his citadel. And this film is that as well, but it's also his sister's myth, and there's one weird thing in Mad Max 2 in The Road Warrior, because there's a fictional name for the oil company logo on the side of the tanker that Max is hauling in the end of the film. It's like a logo, but it's not a real company. And the company's called Seven Sisters Petroleum.
Oh, Jesus.
So I don't know how much of this is unintentional or unconscious. Just myth just generally sort of seeping its way into every corner of this film. But yeah.
That seems very intentional.
It all feels extremely intentional.
Wow. Max straps the rig to a tree as he gets behind it and they're getting fired at. This was an odd scene. Him behind this tree just made me laugh. Max tells them to take the rig down for a bit as he plans to retaliate. Furiosa raises a gun following an explosion, only to see Max come back covered in other people's blood with some supplies in tow.
So it's kind of that whole bit, sort of a, we're going to say homage here. So there's a scene in Seven Samurai, if you knew that film well. It's one character who I've completely forgotten because I haven't watched that movie in a while, but he's the greatest swordsman who's ever lived. And there's a bit in it where he says he's going to go off and get some guns from the bandits who have guns. And we don't see the action scene he takes part in. We see him wander off and then come back a minute later with the guns. So we're left to imagine what terrible violence he must have inflicted on these people to acquire that gear. And it's sort of the same deal here.
Isn't it amazing that Miller uses this wasteland, this desolate apocalyptic vision, to put in all these myths and old stories? I find that fascinating about the guy.
Yeah, you can then. You know, it's I don't know how you would slot in all of these references if you were making a movie set in the real world.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's crazy. Amazing to me because originally it was going to be set in the real world. The only reason they didn't was because they didn't have the money to. We see Max douse himself in mother's milk, which, wow, another just...
Symbolism.
Not very... Symbolism of what?
Well, no, I don't know. It's a... do you know the... I take it you've seen Garth Marenghi's Dark Place? Do you know that show?
No.
Oh, God, right. It's this British comedy series from about 2001, and the premise of it is that it's a horror TV show that was made in the 80s by this egotistical horror novelist who also stars in and directs it. And Matt Berry's one of the actors in it. It's very funny, but it's kind of like a parody of bad horror filmmaking. But in it, we also see interviews with the author of it, Garth Marenghi. And he's got this much quoted line in it where he goes, "I know authors who use subtext, and they're all cowards." And then... it's Max washing himself clean with mother's milk is this movie's subtext is for cowards moment, and I love it.
I'm so glad you make these connections, Mick.
Oh, you need to watch Dark Place.
Repeatedly, sir.
You would love Dark Place. It would be,
sounds like I would, actually, because I love bad 80s horror, so.
Oh, God. And Matt Berry is amazing in it.
We see more flashes from Max as he wakes up in the passenger seat, and we get some backstory from Furiosa, all stuff that I'm guessing we're going to see next week.
Oh, here's... the flashback's weird and interesting, because there's a little bit of footage from the first film. Two critters' eyes popping, but there's that footage of a fetus. That footage is from a Massive Attack video.
Oh, shit, is it really?
Yeah, that's why there's a music credit for Massive Attack in the end credits, even though there's no music for Massive Attack in this. The fact that they used a fraction of that video meant they had to also clear that music track as well. I don't understand how it would be cheaper to get, you know, the visual effects guys to make something that looked like it, but they had a large budget, so they just cleared it. Yeah, for ages I couldn't figure out, was there a Massive Attack song in this film? I don't hear it anywhere, but that's the reason.
Wow. You would think somebody like Miller, who, you know, say what you will about his movies, all the money he spends is on the screen. That sounds like something he wouldn't do. He just took an originally conceived vision and just put it in his film. I find that weird.
Well, you know, it's kind of a...
Well, it gets the job done, but...
And also, I guess if you're up against the clock... And it's easier just to clear a thing rather than getting it done. It's like, I think there's a couple of times in Spider-Man 3 where we hear music cues from Hellraiser.
Yeah, because Chris Brown. Yes.
Simply because there same wasn't composer. Time to re-record something new. I think it's that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
we're seeing a naked girl crying for help on an antenna, and we get Max uttering a now infamous meme quote that I still use to this day. That's bait.
Oh, yeah.
Furiosa takes the bait, though, and soon enough she finds out that the green place is no longer in existence.
Yeah. And the actress who's being the bait, the character's called the Valkyrie, which is a terrific name, that actress Megan Gale, would have been Wonder Woman in Miller's abandoned Justice League film.
Really? So he's just bringing everybody here.
Yeah, yeah. This was kind of, I guess, his way of putting in her movie because he did want to work with her.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is what makes Furiosa break, as she had been fighting and struggling to make her way to peace, which she knew was this green place, but it was all for naught. And in true Fury Road fashion, this scene of her kneeling and yelling to the sky was a scene Charlize Theron herself had to fight Miller for. He refused to let her do it for the longest time, but she finally made him cave. And this is a scene and a shot that is used repeatedly. When people reference this movie, they really reference this scene.
Yeah, and I also like how it's not overwhelmed by an orchestra.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. It's just a really lovely sort of a piece of visual performance that just tells us everything we need to know about her emotions. You know, she doesn't need a big monologue about how sad she is. The green place is gone. That visual just sells it. And it's gorgeously photographed. The way she's framed.
It really is.
The way the light's hitting her, the way there is kind of a sandstorm coming in that was for real when they were shooting it, that you can see the grains of sand rippling across. It is just gorgeous.
Normally I call out these scenes because I hate them. When people are just yelling at the sky. Like, mostly it's just dudes just trying to be macho before they go. They're crying for a woman they had just met. They're getting ready to go fight the bad guys. Here, though, it's used perfectly, and I find it a great piece of storytelling. We're seeing a satellite being explained to the clan, and how in the old world, everyone had a show. Hello, Percolated Media. That's us. You know, I like this scene because we have some old women here, people you normally would never see in a blockbuster like this, just play a pretty important role in telling the story.
Yeah, and I also like the way Miller's using day for night here. I think there was one shot of sort of traditional day for night in Thunderdome.
Mm-hmm.
And normally day for night looks terrible because it always looks artificial. And here shooting at night in the desert wasn't at all feasible. Because the temperature dropping and how uncomfortable that would be. So it is shot day for night, but if they've kind of, they've lent into how unreal it is and how surreal it is, rather than trying to make it look like a realistic night sky, and it's a better choice.
It's a much better choice. In fact, I showed this movie to my fiance. I explained to her that, this is actually during the day. They just had to filter it. And it fooled her. She couldn't recognize it.
And a movie that's contested with masculine hierarchy with Joe, Furiosa, the Wise, and the Vulvalini, I think is what you say, which, if you know your female anatomy, sounds a lot like vulva. This movie's all about like procreation in a forced sense, you know, with Morton Joe, but you also have the creationism with nature, and Furiosa is a mother to these women in service of, like, a greater good. So I like this multi-step approach, especially with older women who you don't see in these type of action movies.
Furiosa pulls Max aside and tells him that she told the others that they're never going to have a better chance to make it across the salt. She says that one of the bikes is Max's and that he's more than welcome to come with them. He says he'll make his own way and that having hope is a mistake and it will make you go insane. More flashbacks to this little girl who calls him Pa, which I did not take this girl as being his daughter. But is he just going crazy, Matt? Is that what we're supposed to bring out here?
Yeah, or it could be, if you believe in Thunderdome as canon, could be one of the kids he tried to save that died in between. You can look at this as maybe he found someone else in between movies and had a new family. Or it could just be fucking crazy.
Max jumps on the bike and joins them as he points them the way home, which is at the Citadel, full of green and water. He suggests they go back the way they came. Furiosa agrees, and they shake on it. Meanwhile, Morton Joe, he comes to the conclusion that they are going back to the Citadel, and they all take off to meet them on the way. We then get another chase, as Max recognizes his car and says, "That's mine," as he shoots at it. And this way of guzzling gas and then spitting into the engine, this was, as the car's moving, this was crazy. Yet another crazy stunt going on here.
This whole sequence and the whole plot point of going back the direction you came in, resolving it just by going back the way you came in, this is all listed from Buster Keaton's 1926 film The General, which a Seven movie nerds and fans of Seven Screen Comedy will try and tell you is one of the great movies, and I could never get on board with that, because The General is a film which Buster Keaton plays a heroic Confederate soldier during the Civil War, and I'm just still not done with that movie, because it's pro-Confederacy. So I'm quite glad to see some of its better ideas being used for a film that isn't this close to being Birth of a Nation.
One of the wives gets knocked off her car, and she takes out a gun and starts shooting before ducking Joe as he approaches. The rig is now in full pursuit as Max cuts some chains and other cars are toppled. Again, just another magnificent scene here. But speaking of magnificent, holy shit, these fucking polecats.
Oh, God.
George Miller really saved the best for last here, didn't he? This is glorious.
Yeah, this is the final rabbit he pulls out of his hat.
Ugh. Why, oh, why would you even try this? It's just amazing that he was able to pull this off.
Yeah, I just even just the engineering problems they had to make possible. The funny way of having people moving on like cantilevered poles that you could mount on vehicles and then have them jump onto other vehicles like pirates boarding another vessel. It's, everyone brings this quote up when they talk about this movie, but if you haven't heard it, the thing Steven Soderbergh said about this film, which is where he said that every time he watches it, he can't believe that hundreds of people aren't dead and that they aren't still trying to make it.
Yeah, I read that. And I also read that Miller says most of the CGI used in this movie was to kind of hide the bungees that are holding these poles, which I get. I mean, you have to use safety precautions here. But still, Soderbergh's right. How people didn't die while making this boggles my mind. And Miller also uses other tricks, because at one point, sound is almost non-existent to illustrate how their cognitive senses are affected by these gunshots and everything going off around them. We have guys with chainsaws rolling them around as one knocks Max off the rig. Furiosa catches him as she's very hurt and then steps on the wheel to take out the car between them. Max jumps behind the wheel of another car, and the race is on as Max makes eye contact with Furiosa. He hops back on the rig and then onto a pole, which takes him out of danger before landing right behind the guitarist. He grabs the guitar and takes out some thugs as Furiosa gets to the front of the rig. Again, just magnificent scene here.
This is the definition of building up to the best action scene in the movie.
It's fantastic.
Okay, there's a couple of things here that happen just sort of, I think, during the sequence that are sort of interesting. There's one sly little, I hate the concept of Easter eggs, but I like this one. One of the bad guys has a shield. He looks like he's got a shield made out of a road sign.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a give-way sign, and I guess Australian give-way signs look exactly the same as Irish and British ones, with like a triangular-shaped sign. And if you look at that, and you look at the holes that are in this shield, it appears to be the give-way sign that gets shot up. In the chase at the start of the first Mad Max film, they specifically made this thing look... Yeah, they've gone and specifically made this prop look like the dinged-up road sign that gets damaged in the opening minutes of the first film, which is... The art department are doing the Lord's work there. But the other one is, and I can't say if... That Max has a little bit of a psychic vision during this whole sequence. You know, when he sees the little girl prompting to put his hand up, and that blocks the crossbow bolt from going all the way into his head. Yeah, that's just fascinating to me. It's like, does Max have precognition in this film? Just, you know,
God,
just
I hope not.
Well, no, but it's a nice, interesting, weird detail, and I think it's probably less embarrassing than the version of that scene that was going to happen in the Mel Gibson version, where instead of him seeing a little girl, it was going to be an Aboriginal guy carrying a briefcase in one hand and a spear in the other. Yeah, it was going to be this. I don't know how it would have come off as a horribly misjudged. I don't know. It might have worked. I can see many ways that might have come across as being sort of the First Nations version of, you know, the concept Spike Lee talks about, the magical Negro.
Yeah, pre-2002 you might be able to get away with it, but not with Gibson
not,
the way. Max gets into it with Rictus as Furiosa gets to Joe. She yells, "Remember me," as his face gets completely taken off. Boy, what a moment this is. Matt, we talk about this a lot, but this is a pretty satisfying death for a villain in a film, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's the literal thing of her literally taking his voice away, you know, the mask,
yes,
which has a mouth painted on it. But it's also just, "Remember me," like, that's all she needs to say.
It's also fun in that it's a symbolic castration, I guess.
Oh, I didn't think of that, but...
Well, I always figure any time in a film, especially a film with these themes, if a guy gets a bodily part ripped off very quickly like that, oh boy.
They get to the pass as Nux says, "Witness me," and turns the rig with Rictus on it, and we get the only moment the 3D version of this movie is good for, as steering wheels and the guitar fly right in our face. Max transfuses his blood to Furiosa, saving her life as he tells her that his name is Max. Was this moment a little too sentimental for this film?
No, I think
Matt, you usually rebel against moments like this. How about you?
Not in the slightest, because it's not like they kissed or physically embraced. He just shows an encapsulation of the humanity he still has.
I buy that.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is, I don't know if you've seen it, if you go online, you can find an early version of the script and storyboard document for this film from about 2002. And I don't know if you've seen that or looked at it, but in that, and it's missing like the last, I don't know, 50 or 30 pages. The thing's already 400 pages long as it is. But throughout it, they don't refer to Max as Max. The character heading for him always just says Road Warrior. So I'm assuming if I had that film script, that this would be the point where they just swap the name over to Max in the script to sort of sell the idea of what an emotional thing it is for Max to finally admit he has a name.
They arrive at the Citadel as Max unveils Emoten Joe's body, revealing that he's been killed. And he kind of gets his body torn apart here by these people. I expected this to be a little more bloody. I did not see much spurt going on as this guy's getting torn apart right in front of us.
I like this. It's the tyrant is dead, and now the peasants can...
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the footage of when there was a revolution in Romania and they killed the Ceausescus?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that grainy home video footage they took of shooting them and then just leaving their corpses there. It's that.
Yeah.
It's that moment, right, where the person whom you thought was... It could never be unseated and had godlike power over everyone is revealed to be mortal and everyone's just going to go and take a piece.
The villagers scream, "Let them up!" as they're lifted to the canyon fortress. Water pours from the canyons and Max and Furiosa exchange a glance as credits roll on Mad Max Fury Road.
And there's a quote?
Yeah, I saw the quote. I didn't feel the need to expand on it, though. Is there something meaningful with that one?
Well, there's a quote. I'm a big fan of movies bookmarking or sort of doing chaptering with quotes. That's the thing that always makes me happy. I like this, that this one ends with sort of a sort of meaningful-sounding one. So there's a quote. Is it, "Where must we go, we who wander the wasteland, in search of our better selves?" And it's attributed to the first history man. So I like the idea that it's a quote from the future.
Okay. All right, that does it for Mad Max Fury Road. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give this very well-loved movie? Mick, you go ahead and go, sir.
I've had 9 years to prep, but I still haven't come up with a bigger number than 10 to mark things out of 10. That's the problem. I mean, I'm going to have to say 10 because there isn't a larger number I can apply. But what I would say is that, you know, this is, I guess, one of these films that's so metal, we should add it to the periodic table as a new element. I think our normal scales for which movies are created just become meaningless, because I think this thing is just so incredible, such an astonishing technical achievement, and, you know, it works so well for me as a narrative. That, yeah, 10, but that feels like I'm not giving it enough.
I have never had a retrospective have this many 10s in it. This is crazy. Matt, are you going to match that?
Remains to be seen. This is kind of the movie I was waiting for, and I didn't realize I wanted it as badly as I did, where we got a blockbuster that has all this money pumped into it, sort of like putting gasoline into a car, where it is full throttle, as you would expect, that's not a pun, and is full of amazing action sequences, but harkens back to the golden era of cinema, where a lot of it is action and characterization without dialogue. There is dialogue here, but it's very blunt. It's oftentimes very literal. And you don't rebel against it because it's contrasted by everything that happens through the way characters behave, through the world, and it's an allegory. Like, this is a Western on wheels, as George Miller put it. Revenge, solidarity, what the context of home means, you know, those are all Western tropes. Not just American Westerns, but the films that were influenced by that over in Italy. Is it my favorite Mad Max movie, though? That was the question. I still like The Road Warrior a little bit better. I don't know if that's controversial, because this movie created debate as to what is the best Mad Max movie. But I give this movie the utmost respect for doing what it did. This is sort of the opposite of Batman and Robin, where Batman and Robin is kind of, in a lot of ways, a blank check movie, where they just said, make whatever you want as long as it turns a profit. This one really feels like George Miller was left to his own devices. And what we got is something that, as I indicated earlier, stood the test of time in the decade plus. Not just because we've had a prequel come out, but it is that damn good. But I can't give it a 10 just because I haven't seen it as many times as I've seen The Road Warrior. Like, I know that movie like the back of my hand. And there is something to be said. This movie is exhausting by the time it's done. You almost want to take a nap when it's done. Or it's the opposite, where you're so humped up on adrenaline that you can't sleep. So I'm going to land on a 9. But don't take that as a slight, anybody. It's fucking great.
We have a 10 and a 9. God. You know, in reviewing this movie again, and rewatching it for this podcast, I have to say, there are so many things about this movie I like. Borderline love. But I don't think I like this movie as much as I respect it. I respect everything that goes into this. You know, you talk about a movie like, for example, Boyhood, like Richard Linklater, had to have the patience to wait for that kid to grow up to make his entire story. And that kind of patience is different than this. I understand that. But it's the same type of filmmaking where Miller had to pursue this vision. He had to convince everybody who write the checks to pursue the vision. He had to keep two stars at each other's throats separated. He had to go to this literal wasteland and film this movie. And just to get it before cameras, he had hell to go through for 13 years, 14 years, whatever it was. I mean, this was a fight to the end. And you can talk about the fight all you want, but the end result is what counts in Hollywood land. And you know what? The end result resulted in 10 Oscar nominations, 6-1, and a movie that has been defined as redefining action. And I cannot disagree with any of that. This movie has so many great points to it. This movie has a feel to it that is unlike any other. If you have anxiety, it will raise your anxiety. As Matt said, it is a fucking exhausting watch. After it's over, I don't care if you watch it at noon or if you watch it at 8 o'clock at night. When it's over, you want to just take a fucking nap. It is exhausting to watch. And, you know, I gave a really good review to it when I first saw it, and I stand by everything I said in that. But again, as I mentioned, it got oversaturated to me, and the overpraise for it really got to me. But in rewatching it, I understand it. I am going to go 8.5 on this, not quite a 9. I think there are so many things to love about it. The lack of characterization still gets to me, but I respect the art behind it. I don't want to take that as a slight. It's just different than what the aesthetic I like in a movie. But still, going through this movie, and I didn't even mention the score, I think the score is better than we've seen in Mad Max movies past, and it propels the action really well. And just, it's an overall good to great ride, but I'm not going to quite go great. It's just on that borderline, but there are so many things I love about it. So 8.5 out of 10 for Mad Max Fury Road for me. And here we are. We have 1 week left. We have one movie left to review. Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, a movie that has been released at the time we record this and is not making as much money as Fury Road made and is not having quite the cultural impact. But what are we expecting when we review Furiosa next week, Matt?
I'm not surprised by its return because it's been a decade. And yeah, I said Mad Max Fury Road has had staying power. But Furiosa is a bit of a different beast. She's a vital component, but let's also remember, movies are not making as much as they, outside of like Barbieheimer, which that's an anomaly in a post-COVID world. So I'm not all that shocked. And my thoughts on the movie, now that I've seen it, I won't get into, but I had one big apprehension going in. I didn't think Anya Taylor-Joy was right for this role. So I had that as a cloud hanging over me walking into the movie.
Mick?
Yeah, I guess my only apprehension with Furiosa was, would it ruin Fury Road for me? Would this be a prequel that I'd watch and there'd be some elements which might ruin Fury Road for me? And no, there's none. It's I'll get into it more next time, but it's a film that definitely, I think, complicates, but also enriches my feelings about Fury Road. But yeah, again, it's even more extraordinary that another one happened.
Yeah, and that's what we'll definitely get into next week. So one more week of Mad Max, and then Matt and I will reveal what we're doing next. So stay tuned to the 3-Minute Retrospective podcast for those reveals. Mick, thank you for joining us, sir, on this journey through the wasteland. You have one more week with us, and then we will cut you free.
On the highway to Valhalla, shiny and chrome.
Until next week, when we review Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. My name is Max. My role is fire and podcast. Thank you, boys.
How does it feel? It hurts. Out here, everything hurts. You want to get through this? Do as I say.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
Welcome to another edition of Thunderdome!
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Anything you say.
Anything I say. What a wonderful philosophy you have. Take him away.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please take a look at some of our other retrospectives, where we delve film by film into such other franchises as Star Wars, the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Indiana Jones, the films of the DC Universe featuring Batman and Superman, and so many more.
The Toe Cutter! He knows who I am! I am the Night Rider!
If you would be so kind, please take a moment to give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
The men, who are they?
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How the hell did you get all this together?
Just happened, Max, you know. Beats from here to beats from there.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
I can do this. I know this machine.
He does. He's a rat hat.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is edited by Garrett. Men and a Retrospective Podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
What do you suppose he's gonna do?
Retaliate first.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
The last we ever saw of him. He lives now only in my memories. Thank you.
He could have been the Joe Pesci from Leo Get. Where he
veers, Lethal Weapon.
He veers too far into just yucks.
Yeah, no, Joe Pesci in Lethal Weapon 2 is fine. I think the worst you could have with this would be Rob Schneider in Judge Dredd.
Oh, shit!
He's the worst part of Judge Dredd. Somebody who isn't even funny, ever. Undermining an action movie that doesn't need another impediment.
I have a guilty pleasure for those Rob Schneider movies, but...
Oh my god.
You should
feel
guilty.
We're never going to do that retrospective. What's that?
You should feel guilty. Normally I say there are no guilty pleasures, but you like those movies, sir, you should just, you know, hang your head in shame, you know.
One other thing I wanted to mention, Matt, is, you know... From Star Wars to a movie me and Matt are going to get to pretty soon, Aliens. There are movies throughout that are really inspired by Vietnam. And now you're saying that this movie in 2015 was also inspired by Vietnam. It's funny how these old school filmmakers go to that well, which, again, I'm not knocking it for it. It's just that war has inspired a lot of great art, no matter how tragic the war actually was. Matt?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was just wondering if you had anything to add.
No, Kate Bush is not my specialty.
Oh, boy. Okay. check out that song. It's, oh, boy.
One of my best friends is a huge Kate Bush fan, and I'm sure he would point it out to me if I were to show him this podcast.
I'll beat you all to the joke, since you're all saying it in your head, I'm not a fan of Bush.
Well, you know, as I've always said, I think the fact that we live in an unjust universe, the best proof of that is the fact that we had two George Bushes, but only one Kate Bush.
Jeez. We have a great shot of this guy.
She can deliver her lines. She's got a certain amount of protectiveness that you actually buy, as she's like the leader of these wives by default. If you remember, like, you look at the rest of them, like, Zoe Kravitz, wasn't she dating Nicholas Holt at this time?
Nicholas Holt is kind of like Pete Davidson, where he's dated, like, half of Hollywood. I couldn't tell you whether
she
was
still,
or wasn't.
Was she still dating Fassbender?
I don't know.
Not to turn this into TMZ, but, like...
I feel like any of these people were ever romantically connected.
Yeah, there's an X-Men connection in this movie.
Mm-hmm. So we had this fight. I see what Miller's doing. He's putting this character in, and next week he's not even here. So I do find it great that I have found another artist in my life that I didn't notice before.
I mean, I kind of think, I at least would hope, like a quarter century after the heyday of shows like Dawson's Creek and, you know, Felicity, the people would now understand the idea that the title character can be boring, and you're watching for all the more interesting people who orbit around them.
I'm so glad you found a Felicity reference to put in here. Nux, once again.
And then because of this movie, a lot of people tried to make this to very lesser degrees.
Like any successful movie, sometimes imitation is not always flattery. Go ahead, Mick.
Yeah. I need the bathroom, so...
You need to use the restroom?
Oh, yeah. Hang on a sec.
Okay, we can wait. In fact, I can go too, if you want to go.
All right, you guys go ahead.
All right.
I think people miss because they're not all immediately spelt out to us by people saying, oh, she did this because, you know, it's it. We're following the action if you're watching this properly, rather than having characters stop and tell us why this character behaved that way. You know, the exposition is all in the action.
Matt, I feel called out. Matt, did you pick up on that?
To an extent, from a certain point of view.
From a certain point of view. Nice.
I've watched bits of it in black and white, and it always feels like something vital is being withheld.
Yeah. Matt, would you agree with that?
From what colors I can actually see, yes.
Oh, that's right. I keep forgetting you're colorblind. I've known you for 10 years, and I keep forgetting that.